Hello, everyone. This is your host, Christian Massara, again with another episode of the Historical Thoughts and Interpretations podcast. Today, what I want to talk a little bit about is the centralization of government in the pre-modern Europe. So we'll talk about new world origins and effects of political change in pre-modern Europe. So we'll go into a little bit about how parliamentary systems started, like early on, how they developed early on, the early development of those systems in countries such as England, France, Spain. And we'll talk about how that helped to centralize power in those areas. And then also we'll look very briefly at a failed case in the Holy Roman Empire. So let's get right into it after this message.
Hello, listeners. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. And I sure hope that you've been enjoying the thoughts given in the Historical Thoughts and Interpretations episodes. But I would like to ask if you would consider making a pledge to the podcast via Patreon. I have many projects in mind for this podcast, and the books, paper, and so on needed to produce the episodes will not be free. Help keep Historical Thoughts flowing so that we can interpret the past and learn from it. You may pledge any amount that you like, and whatever you choose to give will be appreciated. If you'd like to donate, go to my Patreon link at patron.podbean.com/historicalthoughts. And again, that's patron.podbean/historicalthoughts. Now, let's get back to the episode.
One of the most important changes of the Renaissance era was the emergence of the nation-state. This involved the transformation of, quote, divided political entities, in the words of Mary E. Weissner-Hanks, into countries with centralized government institutions. In the 19th century, Jacob Burckhardt said that during the Renaissance, marriage and inheritance were becoming less important in politics. Governance and the creation of states started to become almost an art. And imagined political communities, along with the unifying effects of shared culture, created senses of national consciousness. What emerged by the 18th century was a separate, quote, corporate personality for each state, which vied with others, according to Philip Lee Ralph, Robert E. Lerner, Standish Meacham, and Edward MacDonald Burns, in their book World Civilizations. In this podcast, we'll look at some of the reasons for this shift from inherited to nation-state politics. We will also give answer to the question who won and who lost in the new paradigm. So this idea of imagined communities, it's very interesting because, you know, this is a whole other podcast episode or whatever, but and a lot of other people have thought more deeply about this, but the idea of nationalism or a nation-state is a very interesting one. And that's why a lot of people see it as kind of an imagined thing, because, you know, of course, culture is very real. You know, geography is very real. You know, what is now modern Croatia is inhabited by people called Croats, but for the vast majority of them. You know, Russia is inhabited mostly by Russians, Ukrainians by people calling themselves Ukrainians, and other people will recognize them as Ukrainians. But then also, you know, I always find it a very interesting thing, this kind of difference between being a Canadian legally, and so how can someone be a Canadian culturally? You know, when you're dealing with newer nations like America, like the United States of America was created in 1776, but there were lots of people, what is now the modern United States was inhabited by a lot of other people who might not identify as American, right? Especially First Nations people or Native Americans that were there for a long time before the you know, the white man showed up. So so that's a very interesting thing. And so, like, for, let's pretend someone has American ancestry but grew up in Liberia, I'm not sure, something like that, any kind of a case like that. So is that person really American? Like, for me, my ancestral background is Swedish and Croat, among other groups. But the thing is that I don't speak Croatian. I've only been to Croatia once, and I think that was only for like a week. You know, I'm not ashamed of my Croatian heritage, of course, but I'm not in touch with it in that way, except through my family on my father's side. So, you know, so that idea of being a Croat, like, what does that actually mean? So that's why some people will see this idea of a nation state or something as an imagined thing. right? So, and another question, another thing is, like, the Russian language actually does something very interesting with this, where somebody can be Ruski, like an ethnic Russian, can be a Ruski living in Sasha or America, right? So that's the thing, an ethnic Russian living in the United States. But then there's another term, Rossiyski. So that means a citizen of the Russian Federation, and that could be a Chinese person, a person who is ethnically Chinese. We also have a lot of ethnic Koreans that live in Russia as well, and throughout the former Soviet Union, in fact. But so someone can be a Korean, but also a Russian as well. So, but that person is not ethnically or culturally Russian, except just the fact of living there, but is a Russian citizen. And maybe they have adopted Russian ways by growing up in Russia. Of course, a nation state is a very real thing as well. And so is a culture, so is geography, where that culture lives, where that, Ukrainian culture is centered around Ukraine, right? A geographical area. But again, even the idea of being Ukrainian was developed over time. The idea of being Russian, it developed over time. You know, the original inhabitants of what is now Russia and Ukraine might not be what are ethnic Russians or Ukrainians, right? Same, and again, I mentioned the same example before with America. What someone might identify as an American now, whether they're African-American, Asian-American, European-American, a lot of those ethnic groups weren't there for millennia. You know, again, the First Nations and the Native Americans were there first. So that idea of becoming American, forming what is America, is an imagined thing, right? But that's a whole nother topic, but I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about that. So I think that's a very interesting idea. So now we're going to develop a little bit how some of the developments that happened during this idea, during this time of the development of nation states. Right, so let's get into more on topic here. Not talking so much about imagined communities and things like that. So before we look at the emergence of the nation-state system, it's worthwhile to look at the political paradigm that existed beforehand. In the old system, again, lands were inherited and alliances were built through marital relations. Marriage was a good way to gain territories, position, and wealth. While it was essential to exercise shrewdness and wisdom in the choosing of a spouse, oftentimes for an arranged marriage for someone else, building marital ties was significantly less expensive and risky than waging wars. This point is very clear when we look at the Habsburg family. Through marriages with monarchs from around Europe, the Habsburgs gained lands in modern Holland, eastern France, southern Italy, and even the Spanish Americas. Over time, Austria and Spain were tied together through two branches of the Habsburg family. By the early 16th century, the foundation of marital ties helped or this foundation of marital ties, rather, helped Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire, who was simultaneously Charles I of Spain as well, to consolidate power and finance great armies and navies. In fact, it was new armies like Charles V's that encouraged the shift to nation-state politics. Military technology, especially the adoption of firearms, was drastically changing the face of warfare. First, the predominance of the heavily armored cavalry knight, often a noble, gave way to the infantrymen, armed with longbows, pikes, and then eventually guns. Second, artillery was improved drastically with the use of metal cannonballs. This, in turn, forced fortresses to adapt and change. They no longer had high walls, but they were drastically shortened, and ramparts increased their ability to withstand sieges. And eventually you start seeing different formations, like star formations, star fortresses, and so on. Star forts. But I believe, if I understand correctly, that was more in the late 17th century or the early 18th century, if I'm remembering it correctly. Thirdly, naval forces were also modernized. Not only were ships armed with cannons, but they were also being built with heavier hulls and better sails. This made them better able to take long trips across the Atlantic Ocean, and it made them more suitable for naval combat. This military revolution was by no means an overnight affair. Gwyn Dyer notes that even though primitive guns such as arquebusiers were becoming very prominent on the battlefield, armies were still built around pike formations. And while firearms had replaced archers, they would not have a primary role in warfare until the 17th century. But the new weapons were still an important force for social change. A knight required a lifetime of military training. but a gun-wielding peasants with mere weeks of training could kill a knight in an instant. Dyer says that guns did not change the feudal peasant paradigm by itself. He also cites the world economy and the centralization of government as other important factors. But firearms were certainly part of this crucial social change. Perhaps more importantly, the military revolution required larger armies with longer training, making core standing armies crucial. These were more reliable than feudal knights, for they could spend more time on campaign, allowing them to gain more real battlefield experience. But they were also more trustworthy than mercenaries, who were many but could easily turn on governments unable to pay them. Later in the Hundred Years' War, the French King Charles VII created, according to Larry Addington, quote, 20 companies of ordnance. The men in these companies were paid, allowing them to focus completely on military training in peacetime. They were also kept active as standing forces, ready to maintain order and be ready for any further wars. Military control was gradually centralized. In the words of Dyer, the military revolution was excellent for, quote, absolute monarchs, who wanted to expand the power of the central government, so they began to foster the new infantry armies, end quote. But this came with costs. Professional armies needed to be paid. New ships also needed seamen with special skills, such as gunnery. Rulers needed to hire military architects knowledgeable in new fortification techniques. The costs of all these developments required more efficient taxation and resource management, which was a key factor in the government centralization. Laws and institutions had, of course, been established before, but this increased after the mid-15th century. These systems became much more prevalent and passed more laws. This was especially true because across Europe, fears of crime and rebellion were rampant. England, France, and Spain offer good examples of this centralization process. These three states went through similar processes to achieve central state control. First, they had legislative bodies that approved funds for wars and passed laws. England's parliament was established in the 13th century based on the Magna Carta Agreement of 1215, which limited the king's power. In France, the Estat Général was a national assembly which approved taxes and ruled on religious policy. A parlement, or parliament, of Paris was set up in the 15th century, which acted as a permanent supreme court that the king controlled directly. And in Spain, the Spanish kingdoms of Castile and Aragon established similar bodies as far back as the 11th century. By the 15th century, the Castilian body, the Cortes, was essentially powerless, but the Aragonese court still had a say on taxation. Isabella of Castile married Ferdinand of Aragon in 1469, effectively uniting their realms for their successors. They appointed professional, educated non-nobles to the main royal council, decreasing the nobility's importance in state affairs. So it's moving away from the nobility, the more localized mobility, into a central government. Second, in addition to these institutions like the French Parlement, and the Parliament in England, and the courts in Spain, the monarchs were still in control, even though the legislative bodies did theoretically limit their power to raise taxes. The English Parliament only met when the monarch willed it, and Queen Elizabeth I arrested some members believed to be seditious. The French King Charles VII, mentioning him again, maintained control through his professional companies of ordnance that we saw before. French kings also had the right to lit de justice, which allowed them to appear in the Parlement and encourage the passing of legislation. And until 1498, Isabella and Ferdinand used vigilantes called hermandades to keep the Spanish nobles in line. So despite these similarities, with the similarities of a common kind of institution, and then also the monarchy was still in control of them, there were still some differences between the English, French, and Spanish systems of centralization. The first difference was taxation. In France, the so-called first and second estates, which was the clergy and the nobility, respectively, eventually became exempt from taxes. So these groups were not as concerned with taxes as they were in England. French monarchs also had more taxes to work with, as the provinces instituted permanent taxes of their own. You know, like being in Canada, we have federal taxes and provincial taxes. Secondly, the English Parliament was more legislatively effective, for English rulers did not have the French power of lit de justice. The French government also had to deal with disparate regional law codes and systems, and the Parlement of Paris had little power over regional courts. France's ideal of, quote, one king, one faith, one law, was not necessarily applicable in practice in all cases. Spain was able to consolidate its power centrally, thanks to its unique religious situation that did not exist in England or France. In the early 14th century, Jews who had been expelled from France and England moved into Spain, and many of them converted to Christianity. These Jewish, quote, new Christians, or conversos, became successful in law and other fields. This led to friction with the so-called old Christians, who were not formerly Jewish converts. And the old Christians found an ally in the very religious Queen Isabella when she came to power. They saw the conversos as dangerous to their society. Pope Sixtus IV gave the Spanish monarchs permission to set up an Inquisition. So this was the Spanish Inquisition. This organization was going to investigate conversos to see whether or not they had truly converted to Christianity. The conversos were scrupulously investigated for any signs of retained Jewish practices, such as observing the Sabbath and abstaining from certain foods. Anti-Semitic attitudes were rife in the Inquisition, which believed that, quote, Jewishness was an inherited, almost genetic trait. If anyone was accused of having Jewish, quote-unquote, blood, he could lose everything. This made the Inquisition a potentially useful tool for ambitious individuals who could get rid of rivals by accusing them of being Jewish. Ferdinand and Isabella also used it to increase their central power by implicating suspected dissident nobles. When the Spanish Christians conquered Muslim Granada in January 1492, Spain also subjected its suddenly large Muslim population to persecution. A policy of forced conversion led to a rebellion in the region in 1499. But this revolt was defeated, and the Spanish resumed the forced conversions and began banning Muslim writings. Some Muslims did convert, becoming Moriscos, but the sincerity of these Muslim, quote, new Christians was also doubted, just like the Jewish conversos before them. But by the 17th century, Moriscos were seen as being far more dangerous than Jews. They were part of a, quote-unquote, international Muslim world, which was hostile towards Spain. The refusal of some Muslims to convert, as well as the constant warfare, which led to a declining population, only increased Spanish paranoia. Targeted with a prejudice similar to the, quote, Jewish blood idea, each Morisco was perceived to be a part of a nation entirely hostile to Spain. This was the environment in which a number of Moriscos were expelled from Spain between 1609 and 1610, who were labeled as both spiritual and political threats. From 1609 to 1614, over 300,000 Moriscos left Spain, and many had to leave their children behind. The Spanish persecution of Jews and Muslims not only helped centralize monarchical power, but it also gave them somewhat of an advantage in European politics. Pope Alexander VI awarded Francis and Isabella the title of, quote, Most Catholic Majesties, in recognition of their efforts to repress the non-Christians. This title gave Spanish monarchs increased control over the church, as it was coming from with papal approval. Mary Wiesner Hanks notes that other powers would, quote, only gain such power by breaking with Rome, right? So around the time of the Protestant Reformation, they were able to break with Rome and gain that political power. But in Spain, it was an opposite case, where they were persecuting, you know, apparent what they saw as threats, you know, from Jewish and Muslim converts to Christianity. And so then they actually gained political power and religious power. So it was the opposite situation of what the eventual Protestant states did. Another European power that managed to centralize its power was the Turkish Ottoman Empire. It had many political advantages that made it easier to consolidate and centralize its power. Firstly, over the years since the formation of their empire in the 13th century, the Ottoman Turks had created a strong modern army and navy. Secondly, they built many centralized institutions and created a great bureaucracy filled with trained officials. Slaves, or kul, were selected from a pool of child slaves and appointed as military leaders and administrators. According to Mehmet Sinan Berdal, this system, quote, provided the Ottoman Sultan with a loyal group of officials, end quote, as well as greater government control. Thirdly, the Ottomans had a central capital that did not move. Fourthly, the empire's territory was not divided upon succession. This practice of unigeniture was in great contrast to the Mongolians, for example, whose empire would be divided and thus weakened with each succession. Kievan Rus was the same story. Fifth and finally, the Ottoman Empire was a tolerant state. that allowed conquered areas to keep their own traditions and faiths while still under Ottoman political control. This millet system saw local religious leaders as intermediaries between the people and the Ottoman state. Religion was not seen as an important factor in political unity, as Weisner Hanks says, quote, Christian and Jewish leaders often held high government offices. This was advantageous to the Ottoman Empire because even though the Spanish were able to gain power through religious intolerance, the Ottomans, in their tolerance, could worry less about religion-inspired rebellions. Where the Ottoman Empire succeeded in creating an effective central government, the German Holy Roman Empire failed. Well, largely German. This empire had officials and judicial courts, but not a large bureaucracy like the Ottomans did. The first factor preventing the Holy Roman Empire, or the HRE, preventing its effective centralization was its electoral system. The emperor was in fact elected, forcing rival dynasties to vie with each other for political advantage. Secondly, while the Ottoman Empire was formed by a single dynasty, the HRE was under multiple successive dynasties, including the Salians and the Staufans. After the Staufans lost the empire in 1254, the Habsburgs were left to fight with other families for imperial control. The Habsburgs family finally gained supremacy in the 15th century, but during their struggle for dominance, the imperial estates, these were autonomous institutions with voting rights inside the imperial diet, these estates gained power and had, quote, established their own territorial authority, according to Berdal. Thirdly, the estates and electoral seats were inherited, focusing their attention toward local affairs. This disinterest in broader imperial politics affected even the emperor and the imperial court. And the imperial court was called the, I might butcher the German here, Reichskammergericht. I think that's all right. And the imperial court could not regulate princely competition. A fourth problem was the papacy, which consistently claimed authority over the appointment of the empire's church officials and even taxation. So in conclusion, the HRE was a loose confederation of princes that even the powerful Habsburg dynasty could not effectively consolidate into a centralized nation state. So talking about central states, we've looked at England a little bit, we've looked at France, we've looked at Spain, we've looked at the Ottoman Empire, and we've looked at the Holy Roman Empire. The city is another final area we will look at in this era of political change and centralization. By the mid-15th century, cities had become important because many had turned into independent communes that managed their own taxes, hospitals, and other institutions. The Italian city-states were the most obvious example of this concept, where in the 13th and 14th centuries, nobles had established themselves in cities by marrying into merchant families. However, by the mid-15th century, the Italian city-state system was in decline, in which local politics got entangled into alliances. This allowed stronger city-states, such as Venice and Florence, to consolidate their power by dominating smaller, weaker cities. Although Italy was not united until 1870, this decline of the city-state shows a sort of centralization of Italian power in the hands of a few powerful political bodies. Yet Francesco Sommaini notes that despite the city-state's reduced role, urban centers were still very important in Italy. These centers, even the ones that lost their independence, drove the local economies, making them very wealthy. This made citizenship in these cities very beneficial. In many cities, all male inhabitants had to swear an oath each year in which they promised to defend the city. These citizens did not have the right to vote in city government, but they were privileged with reduced taxes, social assistance, and property rights. Citizenship was also inheritable, making it a very valuable asset, much like citizenship today. After looking at these many political and social changes, we must ask, who won and who lost? Many monarchs gained power through political centralization at the expense of feudal lords and nobles. In Spain, this power was gained through the persecution of religious minorities, as we saw. So in this new revolution, the people skilled in the new ways of war, military architects, gunners, and the new provincial soldiers were guaranteed employment. Guns allowed peasants to gain power over feudal knights, but this made them valuable as soldiers, so one could argue whether this was to their detriment or to their benefit. Also, unless one was a citizen of a city, the new political dynamic did not necessarily make things better for the commoner. The 1215 Magna Carta Agreement in England, for example, did nothing to address a common person's rights. Finally, the changing situation did little for women. According to Wiesner Hanks, although some women became citizens and ruled whole countries, quote, female rulers did not grant or allow other women a more significant political role than male partners did. They named no women as ministers or judges, for example. So, as a whole, the creation of the nation-state system was not very significant for the political good of the common person or the development of democracy, at least not at that time. Over time, of course, democracy comes and everything like that, but at least in this initial step, we don't see this creation of a nation-state as automatically the lessened power of the monarchies and so on, and then the centralization coming to democracy. As we saw, you know, in many of these countries, like in Spain, for example, the monarchy actually gained power through that centralization, right? So just because the nation state was created, that didn't necessarily mean that democracy and equal rights for women and so on were coming automatically. That did come gradually. So I just want to thank you for listening to this latest episode, the second episode of 2024. I definitely hope to do more. Again, I'm not a believer in New Year's resolutions, but I do believe that a new year is a good opportunity to produce more, to do more than we did last year. Last year, I only did one episode. Oh, boy. So anyway, I want to say thank you. I hope you're all doing well, and take care.